misleading kiss. A foreword. A miracle is defined as the occurrence of an impossibility that can only be explained by supernatural intervention. By definition, a miracle is the least probable event to occur since it is considered an impossibility or nearly impossible. Therefore, if a natural explanation for an event can be proposed, it is intrinsically more probable than a miracle because it does not invoke any supernatural phenomena to support it. By explaining this hypothesis, I hope to propose a plausible, natural explanation for the events surrounding the acclaimed death and resurrection of Jesus. This is not to be considered positive evidence that refutes the miraculous explanation of the Easter events as described in the New Testament, but rather the establishment of a firm and reasonable doubt against it. The premise. The high priests of the Jewish nation had heard of a grassroots movement led by a man called Jesus, and they were beginning to worry. Jesus had been convincing the people in the Jewish community that deliverance from Roman rule was at hand, and according to the Orthodox Jewish community, Jesus' claim to divinity was blasphemous. Jesus claimed that he was God's chosen vessel to lead the way to revolution. The high priests did not want a snake in the grass leading a revolt and undermining their orthodox authority, and their answer was to cut off the snake's head. But Jesus was not easy to find. That's when the incredible luck of Judas the betrayer came along. Judas and the high priests wanted the same thing, Jesus dead. And Judas promised to help them find and arrest Jesus. So they made an agreement, 30 pieces of silver in exchange for the arrest of Jesus. The sun had set and nightfall had blanketed the city. The time had come for Judas to lead the Jewish guards to Jesus. When they arrived at the scene, they didn't know who Jesus was. The only way for the guards to pick Jesus out of the crowd was for Judas to point him out. Otherwise, they couldn't recognize the King of the Jews by face. Judas devised a plan to subtly point him out to the guards. The first man Judas approached and greeted with a kiss on the cheek would be Jesus, the one they called Messiah. This was the signal for the guards, a kiss of betrayal. The entire scenario rested on Judas's kiss, and it is in this detail that a seed of doubt has sprouted in my mind. Was Judas actually betraying Jesus? Or was it collusion to save Jesus, the only hope for Israel's salvation? All it would take was a simple misdirection, a simple plan to fool the guards and save Jesus. Judas simply had to kiss someone else. He could have kissed anyone, and the guards would have believed him. They could have arrested the wrong man, and they would never have known it. Jesus only needed two pawns to make this plan work, a betrayer and a sacrificial lamb to take his place. Devising the plan. Certainly, saving God's messenger is a worthy motivation for such a sacrifice. Even Jesus said, "Greater love has no one than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." Surely those words buzzed in the minds of his followers. Someone could have, and likely would have, volunteered to take Jesus' place. The restoration of the children of Israel to the Holy Land was worth it. It was unlikely that the sacrificial lamb would get any personal credit. It was, after all, a job of impersonation. At the Last Supper, Jesus explicitly said to his disciples that one of them would betray him. I've always viewed this as an odd scenario if the Bible is to be taken literally. Wouldn't the mere prediction of betrayal have pierced Judas's heart and made him fearful? Wouldn't he have been ashamed that somehow Jesus already knew of his plan? Wouldn't Judas realize he stood no chance at fooling and betraying Jesus? If Jesus can see the future and read minds, how could Judas possibly betray him? Maybe Judas was a nitwit and thought he could still get away with it, or maybe there's another explanation. What if the announcement of betrayal at the Last Supper was less of a prophecy and more of a directive? Jesus was revealing a plan. Someone from Jesus' close circle needed to defect and pretend to betray his own master. The apostles asked Jesus who it would be. Jesus replied, "It is he to whom I will give this morsel of bread when I have dipped it." John 13:26. After he dipped it, he gave it to Judas. Judas was selected. Then in verse 27, Jesus said to Judas, "What you are going to do, do quickly." The scenario has the appearance of a plan being devised, with roles being assigned by Jesus, the mastermind. Every other crucial detail of the New Testament could still be true. Jesus was a real person. He had followers. A crucifixion occurred. A Christ follower died on the cross and was buried after. There was an empty tomb. Jesus was seen alive even after the crucifixion. All these events could have still occurred with one single difference. The wrong man was arrested and crucified. Rebuttals. Wouldn't people have noticed that it wasn't Jesus on the cross? According to my hypothesis, the apostles knew the plan. It's unlikely they would have jilted the plan by revealing that it was not Jesus on the cross. Those apostles would have been more concerned with hiding and protecting Jesus and themselves during the events of the crucifixion. Matthew, Mark, and Luke make no mention of apostles anywhere near the crucifixion scene. Only John, in the oldest gospel written, appears to reference himself at the scene. Again, the apostles aren't of concern anyways. The disciples who may not have known the plan, who are reported to have been at the crucifixion scene, were the four women who came with Jesus from Jerusalem and Galilee. But the Bible even admits that they were looking on from a distance. Mark 15:40-41. In other words, they wouldn't have been close enough to see the crucified man's face anyways. To add to the unlikelihood that the crucified man would have been recognized, his face and body had been beaten, and a crown of thorns placed on his head. His face would have been swollen and covered in blood, dripping from the thorns piercing his head. He was likely unrecognizable, even close up, adding cover for the already surreptitious plan. What about the evidence of apostolic martyrdom? If the apostles all knew Jesus hadn't died and resurrected, why would they die a martyr's death for something they knew was a hoax? The apostles believed Jesus was the Messiah to deliver Israel from Roman rule, in spite of their awareness that the resurrection was a hoax. It is unfair to say the apostles were martyred strictly for their belief in a resurrected Jesus. They had strong convictions about the divinity of Jesus' messiahship before the resurrection. They were willing to abandon their professions and possessions for Jesus, live their lives following him, and even die for his cause before the crucifixion took place. Their commitment to and willingness to die for Jesus did not depend on a resurrection, rather the belief that Jesus would deliver Israel. The fact that Jesus was still alive and had narrowly escaped crucifixion was enough to keep the apostles' devotion alive too. There was plenty of motivation for the apostles to keep hush about their knowledge of the hoax. There would have been immense embarrassment admitting they were in on it. Hundreds and eventually thousands of people came to believe in Christianity as a result of this purported miracle. It was proving to be an incredibly useful tool for gaining converts to support the cause. Why ruin a perfectly good thing? It's no stretch of the imagination to think a cult might justify lying for a good cause. The end justifies the means, as the saying goes. After all, they weren't technically lying by saying Jesus was alive. He who speaks less wins. Throughout the interrogations by the high priest and Pontius Pilate, the Jesus impersonator was incredibly silent. When asked to defend himself against accusations, the impersonator said nothing. When asked if he was the king of the Jews, his response was, "You have said so." Mark 14:60-62. That answer is remarkably akin to saying, "If you say so," or, more modernly sarcastic, "Whatever you say, boss." He's avoiding lying by not answering yes outright, while still maintaining his impersonation. His refusal to answer any other question was likely a brilliant injunction by Jesus the Mastermind, lest he say something doltish that disaffirmed his disguise. A broken heart. Judas's post-crucifixion behavior is odd for a betrayer. It's almost as if he spent a microsecond being a traitor. He didn't enjoy the spoils of betrayal. Almost immediately he returned the silver, exclaiming that it was blood money. Then, in a dramatic undertaking, he kills himself. Are those really the actions of a betrayer, or of a remorseful man? Judas felt guilt and sorrow. Those emotions are indicative of a man who still loved Jesus and his followers. A true betrayer would have reveled in the success of his plan and enjoyed the silver that came with it. What motivation did Judas have to betray Jesus in the first place? He had nothing to gain by it, especially compared to everything he had to gain if Jesus truly was the Messiah who would deliver Israel from the rule of the Romans. Judas's guilt and suicide tell us that he loved whoever he betrayed, be it Jesus or another disciple. He betrayed someone close to him. Judas was responsible for setting the crucifixion in motion, and he was sorrowful. Perhaps he didn't anticipate the guilt that he'd feel when he agreed to the plan. In the beginning, maybe the ends seemed to justify the means, but the confidence that bolstered him to follow through with the plan did not remain after it. Jesus in Kashmir. Some scholars believe that Jesus' teachings have exceptional hints of Buddhism in its philosophical aroma. There is belief that Jesus spent many of his early years learning from gurus in the East, and that explains the New Testament silence of Jesus' life from childhood to around age 30. After the crucifixion of Jesus' impersonator, it would have been a volatile environment for Jesus to merely resume his messianic leadership. A much safer option would be to leave town and return a second time to fulfill the prophecies of the restoration of God's kingdom on earth at a later date. The promise was that the prophecy would be fulfilled in the disciples' lifetime. Jesus said, "Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Matthew 16:28. The disciples believed that Jesus would return in their lifetime, but that never happened, and people are still waiting for a second coming to this day. There are reports that Jesus returned to Kashmir and even died there, never making his return to the Holy Land. The reports that Jesus returned to Kashmir lend credence to the idea that he didn't die on the cross and didn't ascend into heaven, but rather lived and died like a normal human being. Of course, from the perspective of Jesus' followers in the Holy Land, something miraculous had happened. People saw the resurrected Messiah with their own eyes, and stories began to spread. Conclusion. The ideas in this hypothesis are mostly philosophical in nature and therefore appeal to logical reasoning more than hard facts. The difficulty about historical claims is that they are not events that can be repeated, controlled, and observed in a scientific experiment. What actually happened to Jesus 2,000 years ago is impossible to establish. The only tool at our disposal is logical reasoning to help make sense of the events purported by the Bible. The Christian faith is built on the premise that something impossible happened. A dead man returned to life. This is an extraordinary claim. It is central to Christianity. Paul recognizes that the whole Christian faith pivots on this point. If Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain, and your faith is in vain. 1 Corinthians 15:14. The truth of Christianity is directly proportional to the truth of the resurrection of Jesus. To doubt the resurrection is to doubt Christianity. The claim of resurrection is one that does not comport with the way we understand biology. Through mere experience, it is clear we live in a world where dead people stay dead. There are heaps of anecdotal stories of near-death experiences. The common denominator in all near-death experiences is that the person approached near death but did not fully cross the line into death. When someone nearly dies, their heart might stop beating, their lungs may stop breathing, and they may even be pronounced medically dead at the scene. But if they are resuscitated, then it can be fairly concluded that brain function had not reached full cessation. Brain death is irreversible. As far as scientific consensus is concerned, no one has ever returned or recovered from brain death. It has not happened even once. This hypothesis proposes a natural explanation for Jesus' alleged death and post-death appearances that coincides with the fact of the finality of death. A natural explanation is more parsimonious and therefore intrinsically more likely to be true than a supernatural one. Finally, it is important to understand that there are two types of disbelief. The first is called positive disbelief. This type of disbelief is arrived at by providing evidence that directly falsifies a truth claim. For example, if I claim there is a golden teapot in the cupboard and upon opening it, you find it is completely vacant, then you have positively found my claim to be false. The other type is called agnostic disbelief. This type is arrived at by either a complete lack of evidence to support the claim or by finding the evidence provided to be utterly weak and unsatisfactory. For example, if I claim there is a golden teapot on the dark side of the moon, but provide no evidence to support the claim, you are under no obligation to believe my claim. Perhaps I provide a photo of the golden teapot on the surface of the moon, but you understand that photos can be photoshopped, so skepticism demands you remain agnostic until more evidence is provided to demonstrate the legitimacy or illegitimacy of the photo. In the meantime, belief is suspended until better evidence is provided, so agnostic disbelief is the default position. While it may appear that I am appealing to positive disbelief by providing an alternative hypothesis to the resurrection story, I am actually making a case for agnostic disbelief. Christian apologists argue that we should accept the New Testament narrative of the resurrection of Jesus because it is the only narrative that makes sense of the crucifixion, empty tomb, and eyewitness accounts of Jesus post-crucifixion. By proposing a hypothesis that makes no supernatural claims, I have demonstrated that the Christian narrative is not the only way to make sense of the events. Therefore, there is no compelling reason to accept the Christian narrative as the most probable narrative. There is ample reasonable doubt to establish agnostic disbelief about what actually happened to Jesus. Bonus hypothesis. In case the misleading kiss hypothesis is unconvincing, I've comprised another hypothesis for even more food for thought. This time, instead of the misdirection occurring at the arrest of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, imagine the act of dupery occurs in Pilate's headquarters. After the high priests had finished interrogating and abusing Jesus, they sent him over to Pilate for interrogation. Pilate asks Jesus questions and ultimately finds no guilt in him. He tells the Jews to crucify Jesus themselves. He will not do it because Jesus is an innocent man. But the Jews would not have it. The Bible describes the scene. Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" A third time he said to them, "Why? What evil has he done? I have found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish him and release him." But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. Luke 23:20-25. Pilate's own conscience was in direct conflict with the demands of the Jewish crowd. To complicate the matter for Pilate, his own wife beseeched him not to harm Jesus. The Gospel of Matthew relays her effort to sway his decision in Jesus' favor. Besides, while he, Pontius Pilate, was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." Matthew 27:19. Pilate had his own conscience, his wife's pleas, and the Jews' appetite for justice all clamoring for him to appease their wishes. Then the perfect opportunity presented itself. There's another man in Pilate's custody who had been found guilty on charges of insurrection and murder. His name was Barabbas. Pilate had a brilliant stroke of genius. He devised a plan to release one of these accused men according to the crowd's selection. If the crowd chose to release Jesus, Pilate's conscience and his wife's wishes would be satisfied, and the crowd would get what they wanted. If the crowd asked for Barabbas to be released, Pilate would deliver Barabbas over to be crucified in Jesus' place. Pilate merely had to switch Jesus' and Barabbas' clothes, release Jesus, and crucify Barabbas instead. After beating Barabbas and putting a crown of thorns on his head to cover his face in the dripping blood, he'd hardly be recognizable. Pilate even went as far to write an inscription labeling the released man with a sign declaring him King of the Jews. Of course, Barabbas would not be informed of the plan. For all Barabbas knows, he was being crucified as punishment for his own crimes. Pilate releases Barabbas in Jesus' place, then secretly imprisons Jesus until after Barabbas is crucified and buried. After Barabbas is buried, Pilate then instructs the Roman guards to watch the tomb. In the middle of the night, on the Sabbath, the guards would remove and dispose of Barabbas' body, lest the high priest discover it wasn't really Jesus who died, and then retaliate for the violation of justice. Pilate fabricated a story and instructed the Roman guards to claim that while they had fallen asleep, Jesus' followers stole the body, thereby deflecting all responsibility for the scandal. Pilate then releases Jesus on one condition. Jesus must leave town. Sunday morning comes, and the women followers of Jesus find the tomb empty. Jesus, having been released from Pilate's custody, clandestinely visits his followers. His followers can't believe it. Jesus is alive. It's a miracle. Jesus reunites for a short time, but then, as promised, leaves town, but promises to return. The spark that ignited the Christian movement has gone full blaze. Meanwhile, Pontius Pilate revels in his brilliance. He appeased the Jews, the Christians, his wife, and his own conscience. He had successfully devised and executed a win-win, win-win solution.